Are you ready to be connected? You're listening to the Insured Connection Podcast by Pika Group, a pro assurance company, where we provide expert advice for your practice when you need it most. We connect you with industry leaders to discuss timely topics so you can listen, learn, and get back to caring for your patients. Now, let's connect.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Ross Taubman, and I'm the President and Chief Medical Officer of the Pika Group. Today, we're going to talk to one of our premier claims specialist, Jeff Hart. And the topic today is the three characteristics of being a defendant in a malpractice suit. So Jeff, let me first welcome you to the podcast, and we're glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Jeff, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been with the company and what you do for the company.
I've been with Pika for almost 25 years now, and I'm a claims specialist. Been a claims specialist for most of that time. I'm the director of claims for the podiatry, dental, and chiropractic policyholders.
Wow. I bet you've seen a lot of stuff through your years.
Cases. Some cases are really, really mundane and everything kind of goes according to plan. And then some cases you hear some of the most outlandish things you could have dreamed of. And so there's some pretty, every claim specialist at Pika at OUM has some stories that they could tell about some of the things they've witnessed in their cases.
Okay, so we our audience is podiatrists and chiropractors and dentists, but we're going to use a specific case that was a case that you worked for the company that ultimately went to trial. So we're going to talk about some components of that and some of the lessons learned, if you will, or things to do. So before we even get to a lawsuit, documentation is pretty darn important in every single lawsuit, is it not?
Very important. It kind of lays the foundation for the defense and actually is a good preventative measure to even prevent lawsuits from even being filed.
So is it fair to say that if the documentation is poor, that will become a central issue or is a central issue in every lawsuit, perhaps leading to credibility of the doctor going forward? Is that correct?
That is correct. And it's very important because plaintiff's attorneys will question a witness about the importance of documentation. And they'll also try to illustrate for the jury or argue to the jury that if it's not documented, it didn't happen.
One of the first sort of myths that I want you to debunk is just because you got sued, does that mean you committed malpractice?
No. A lot of times what happens is somebody has had what we call a malocurrence, but it's not malpractice. They may experience a complication. They may have a lofty expectation of what their outcome is going to be. And so if it's anything less than that, they can start looking for what caused that to happen. And they may try to place blame on the doctor for the outcome.
So is it fair to say that in most cases where there's obvious negligence on the part of the doctor, those are cases that generally don't ever go to trial? They end up being settled in advance. So for instance, if you do a procedure and you say that you're going to operate on the left side and you operate on the right side, as an example of that, most carriers aren't going to take anything like that to trial. That's going to be a settlement. Is that correct?
That's correct. Those cases never make it to trial. And then there's some obvious surgical error type cases. If bones were put into fused in an improper position, the evidence is just apparent on x-rays. And so when there's an obvious error made, those cases don't make it to trial. Those cases are typically settled and doctors don't want to go to trial on those cases and be in front of a jury in their community testifying about their care.
Okay. So as a podiatrist or a chiropractor or as a dentist, how important is a consent form to protecting or to defending the doctor?
The consent form is important. What's more important, though, is the discussion that takes place along with the signing of the consent form. Many times, patients will allege that they were given a stack of papers to sign by the doctor, and they knew if they didn't sign those documents, they wouldn't be having the surgery that they think they need. So it's the consent discussion. So if the records document that the doctor went over the consent form with the patient and went through the list of complications with the patient, and then the patient signs the form, then the actual conversation that took place that the doctor is going to testify about, his documentation and the records of the conversation that he had, and then the actual signed document by the patient, those three things kind of work together to give the doctor credibility when he is trying to illustrate for the jury that he did get consent from the patient for whatever the procedure was. And so all three things have to go together. The consent form is important, but the conversation is probably more important, and the consent form just helps to document that conversation.
So you mentioned a couple of times now about the doctor having the conversation and the documentation. So whose responsibility is it to take to go over consent with the patient? Is that something that I should delegate to my staff, or is that something that I, as the doctor, should be doing myself?
It's important for the doctor to have the discussion with the patient and not one of the staff people, because patients are trying to make a decision as to whether or not they need to undergo this procedure, and they need to be able to ask questions of the doctor and get the doctor's response. There could be questions that the patients would ask a staff person that the staff person wouldn't have the same level of understanding that the doctor would. And so it's important that the doctor have that discussion.
Okay. We probably could do an entire podcast on just proper way to take informed consent, but let's move on here, because I want to get to a specific case and use as an example. And again, for those listening, whether you're a podiatrist or a chiropractor or a dentist, the specifics per se of the case and the fact that this was a foot surgery case we're going to talk about really is not what's important. What's important is really the anatomy around the particular case.
Like what you're hearing? Go ahead and subscribe so you never miss an episode again. Now, let's continue to connect on today's topic.
So a lawsuit comes in, Jeff, and the policyholder notifies us of the lawsuit, and that gets assigned to somebody like you as a specialist, and we assign attorneys. So really high level, what are the next steps? What happens in a lawsuit once the lawsuit's been filed?
There's a defense attorney assigned by the company. We have attorneys who are experienced in handling podiatric, chiropractic, and dentist malpractice cases. There's some written exchange of information. We call it interrogatories in most states. It's called something different in a few states, but there's a written exchange of information. And then there are depositions that are taken to try to start. Both sides need to start figuring out, if this case has to be tried, what is the evidence going to be in trial? And finding that out early on in the depositions lets both sides know what they need to do to try to reach resolution to this case. Is this a case that needs to be resolved in trial? If the case is defensible, that's where it needs to be resolved. If the case has weaknesses that come out in the depositions, but maybe the case is still defensible, then we have to try to evaluate, can we overcome these weaknesses in front of a jury in this venue? So it becomes more complicated when there are some weaknesses in the case. We have cases that are really strong. We have cases that have a few weaknesses that we have to overcome. And then we have cases that we really don't think we can win in trial. So.
Okay, so we go through this process of trading information, both sides trade information, depositions are taken. I assume experts are found, expert witnesses are found, both for the defense, for the policyholder, and for the plaintiffs. How are those people picked? Who makes a good expert?
Experts tend to be reused if they do a good job. We know who the good experts are in the various specialties that we insure. You know, we're fortunate that we have a narrow focus. We're not just a complete multi-specialty group. So we have a lot of podiatric malpractice cases. We have fewer dental cases because they don't get sued as often. And then we have even fewer than that chiropractic cases. But we know who the good experts are in most of the venues where we have claims. And the defense attorneys know who the good ones are because they've used them before. And what makes them good is how they perform on the witness stand, how they perform as a witness in deposition. Do they have knowledge of what's in all the medical records? Do they have good credentials? Are they published? Did they publish on the procedures in question? And then do they appear trustworthy? And so that's what we look at when we're trying to decide who we want as an expert. And when you find people who do a good job in all those areas and meet all the selection criteria, we tend to go back to the well with those people and use them time and again. And for good reason, we have success with them.
Wait a second. I thought that we had, this is a case of whether the doctor did something right or the doctor did something wrong, but you're telling me that all these other aspects, like the credentials of an expert, matter. Why does that matter? Isn't this a jury of my peers? Isn't this a group of people judging me that are podiatrists or chiropractors or dentists? Isn't that how our system works?
No, they're not a jury of your peers. It's lay people. It's factory workers. It's business people. You have people that are unemployed on juries. You have people who are blue collar. You have people who are white collar. You very seldom will have a doctor on a jury because they will get out of jury duty many times because of their obligations. But also a plaintiff's attorney will not want a doctor on the jury. If we're taking a case to trial, it's because the case is defensible. He doesn't want a doctor understanding the defenses of our case. And so they're going to boot a doctor or a nurse off the jury in almost every situation. So it's not going to be a jury of your peers.
So one of the three characteristics is credibility, right? So it's credibility not only of our experts, it's credibility of our lawyers, and perhaps most importantly, it's the credibility of our doctor who's the defendant in the lawsuit. Would you say that's among the most important things is credibility?
Right. The insured is, his credibility is the most important. And the expert just has to be able to convince the jury that he is an expert on the matter that's in question in the case, the procedures that are in question in the case. But the insured's credibility is the most important. They're trying to figure out what he did. Can we trust his testimony and do the records back up what he's saying?
So let's use a particular case and we'll protect the identity of both the patient and the doctor in this particular case. But just to set it up, the patient was a 22-year-old female college soccer player who had a bad bunion on one of her feet. Ultimately, after failing conservative care, the policyholder did a bunionectomy on the doctor. And then what caused the doctor or caused the patient to ultimately sue was that there was the bunionectomy was slow to heal. The bone was slow to heal afterwards. And there were some components about whether the doctor performed the procedure correctly was one of the allegations on behalf of the patient. And then one of the defenses on the other side of the coin was that the patient was not compliant with what the doctor asked the patient to do in a post-operative phase. So is this just a matter of he said, she said, or talk a little bit just about those components and the importance of compliance and our documentation and also how the doctor comes across when they're discussing the case in front of the jury.
Okay. You mentioned one of the characteristics of what makes a good witness earlier, and that was credibility. But there's two other characteristics that we look for. We look for someone who's caring and someone who's competent. And so if they're caring, competent, and credible, that gives them credibility with the jury. It turns them into a doctor that the jurors would want to treat with. So in this particular case, it was alleged that our doctor did the procedure wrong and didn't put one of the bones in the correct position when doing this particular bunion procedure, and that led to problems with some of the other toes in her foot. So we were able to illustrate with our insured doctor and with our expert testimony that they knew what they were doing. They followed proper protocol. But one of the big factors in this case was how well our insured doctor performed on the witness stand. He knew that the audience was was the jury. He wasn't talking to the plaintiff's attorney when the plaintiff's attorney was asking him questions. He was explaining things to the jury. He would turn to the jury and talk to them and communicate and make a connection with them. He was competent, and then his credibility was enhanced by his tremendous records. He documented every instance of noncompliance when the patient would come in and wasn't wearing the boot that he had prescribed postoperatively. He documented that, and he explained to the patient that she needed to wear this boot, and he explained to her why and what could happen, and he documented this. And so when he documented this, and then when he testified to what was documented, the records backed him up, and the patient denied that the doctor said these things, but the records that were created at the time that the treatment was provided gave our doctor the credibility that he needed to prevail.
So you've talked about the three characteristics: caring, competent, and credible of our doctor, but our defense attorney plays a part in this case as well. And in this particular case, one of the interesting things that happened, or one of the things that that we did as a company in defending our doctors, is we were trying to show a theory that the patient was not compliant with the instructions of our doctor. And so not only did we have the record and what was documented, but in this particular case, we hired a private investigator who went out and researched some things on social media. So talk a little bit about what happened in this case because of that, because it ultimately matched what the doctor was saying that they told them to do. So what happened in this case?
Right. There's a company that specializes in social media research for the purpose of litigation. And so we hire them on many cases to research the social media accounts of the plaintiffs that are suing our doctors. In this case, there was a Facebook post that was located where she made the comment that the only thing this boot is good for is crushing my beer cans. And so when we're trying to put on a case in front of the jury that indicates or illustrates that she didn't value what this boot was doing for her and for her recovery, then this social media find helped to back that up. And so when she was testifying about how religiously she wore this boot, then the defense attorney asked her, so could you then explain to us what you meant in your social media post on whatever the date was when you said the only thing this boot is good for is crushing my beer cans? And the courtroom was just quiet and her mouth dropped open and she said, but I was just kidding. But the point was made for the jury. And so then the credibility of our insured, when he was testifying, he was communicating with the jury, his documentation was spot on. And it was perfect and it was complete. Everything just painted a picture for the jury that we wanted them to see.
So is it fair to say at the end of the day, you've already made the point that this is not a jury of your peers. These are lay people who in most instances don't have any medical knowledge. So their ability to understand the medicine is less important than who they like the best or who they think is most credible or most believable. And in this case, that's probably a pretty good example the jury decided that our defendant doctor was more credible than the patient. Is that fair assessment?
More credible, and they believed that he cared about patients. That documentation about how she needs to wear the boot and what it does for her, that demonstrates the caring aspect. He's not just letting this patient do what she wants. He's on top of everything and explaining to the patient, this is what you need to do and why. And while it's not a jury of your peers, I think the jurors are a lot of times trying to figure out, is this a doctor that I would want to treat with if I had a condition similar to what the plaintiff in a particular case has? And I've had another case that I'm thinking of right now too, where when the jury went back to deliberate, we talked to the jurors after they rendered the verdict. They hung around and wanted to talk to us. And we asked them, what helped you decide this case, or why did you decide in our favor? And the jurors, first thing they did when they went back to deliberate is they asked themselves, if you had to treat with one of the four doctors in this specialty who testified, which one would it be? And they picked our insured doctor. They didn't even pick our expert. Most of the time, I would think they would pick our expert because these guys are just cream of the crop. They are, they're qualified. They're impressive. You would think that they would pick our expert, but they didn't pick our expert. They picked our insured doctor because they thought he cared. So
interesting. So at the end of the day, in this particular case, the jury received the testimony and then went out to render a verdict. And what happened in this case?
They were out for only about 30 minutes. And when a jury comes back with a verdict in that short a period of time, there's no guarantee what the decision is. But when it takes them 30 minutes or less, or 40 minutes or less, it's usually a defense verdict, because that means the very first question that they have to answer is, was the doctor negligent? Did his care deviate from the standard of care? And if they answer that the doctor was not negligent, or the doctor's care did not deviate from the standard of care, then their deliberation is over and they're returning a defense verdict. And so that's usually what that means. It was about 30 minutes. The jury came back with a defense verdict in this case.
That's awesome. So Jeff, let's sum things up. What are the points that we want the listener to understand about the three characteristics of being a defendant? Let's go through that one more time.
Caring, documentation of the time that you spend with the patient and the conversations that you have with them. It helps us on the defense side when a doctor does more than just says, I discussed X with the patient, I got consent from the patient. It helps more when you talk about what was discussed with the patient, and because that demonstrates caring, and the time spent communicates caring to a jury. Competence, sometimes doctors are more nervous. Our doctor in this case that we've talked about primarily here today, he was supremely comfortable, and he may have felt a little nervous. It did not show. He was expert quality, and he was phenomenal. But some doctors are nervous, and one conversation I had with a doctor one time was, all you got to do is tell the truth. The truth is easy to tell, and you know this story better than the plaintiff's attorney does. Just tell your story. And let the defense attorney guide you with his questions, but you tell the story and just tell the truth. And And so, and that's easy. The a lie is hard. The truth is easy. And so, he worked with the attorney to try to sell his competence, and it worked. And so competence has to be illustrated with your testimony and your understanding of the medicine and explanation of why you did what you did, when you did it. And then credibility, records, the way you communicate, you don't get into a jousting match with the plaintiff's attorney, but you explain things to the jury. You know, and we were talking about documentation earlier. Documentation helps you win a malpractice case, but it also helps you prevent a malpractice case. If a case is well documented, most plaintiff's attorneys are going to look at it. They're going to see that this is a difficult case for them to win. It's not a good financial investment, and it's a case that they may turn away from.
Thank you. So at the end of the day, when you get sued, having an experienced defense counsel, having experienced claim specialists like we have at PICA Group is part of the equation, but the credibility, the caring, and the competence of the doctor is paramount in being successful in a lawsuit.
It is. If any one of those three is missing, it just makes the defense a little bit harder. If credibility is missing, that's probably the most important. Some doctors don't present as warmly. They don't have that warm way about them that wins people over, but they can still be caring. And competence is basically communicating what you did. But credibility, if the jury doesn't trust you, then they can disregard your testimony altogether.
Thanks, Jeff Hart. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you for taking us through this case and for educating us on the three characteristics of being a defendant in a lawsuit. This is Dr. Ross Taubman, President and Chief Medical Officer of PICA Group, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of The Insured Connection.
And that's it for this week's episode, but let's continue connecting. If you're enjoying The Insured Connection, don't forget to leave a review on your streaming platform and subscribe now so you can connect with us each time we post a new episode. To stay connected with us throughout the week and to tell us topics we should discuss on future episodes, go to PICAGroup.com/insuredconnection.